Welcome to Creative Conversations. I'm Roger Humphrey. In this episode, I'm pleased to welcome the award-winning Canadian filmmaker, Daniel Ferguson. His movies are extremely special because he only works in IMAX, giant screen, planetariums, and in domes. Everything is in high def and occasionally even 3D. Hey, before we begin, please hit that like, follow, and subscribe button down there, and all the other buttons that you happen to see. It's an easy thing to do, and it really does help the channel a lot. Also, leave a comment. Let me know what you think. Your opinion is very important to me. Thanks. And we are welcoming to the program Daniel Ferguson, producer, writer, director. You probably bake cookies, too, for your crew.
Listen, the way to Goodwill is through the stomach, Roger. So, you know, you've given me a great idea for how to...
So you've been doing this for a minute or two. You are with Cosmic Picture, which you guys do IMAX and big screen stuff. Prior to that, you were with Conan O'Brien. That must have been a big jump to go from that show to doing what you're doing now.
Well, I'm going to correct you. I mean, as much as I'd love to say I've worked with Conan, no, you know, my background actually, Roger, is I'm Canadian. I'm a filmmaker. I've worked in documentary, narrative, some commercials, and found my way to the IMAX world. It's so funny because I actually wanted to have Conan narrate one of my films, and I ended up working with, I'll say, one of his colleagues and proteges, Mindy Kaling, actually.
Yeah.
You know, who narrated The Heart of New England, one of my films. But no, alas, I did not work with Conan. So that may be another Daniel Ferguson. We're sort of ubiquitous out there, I guess.
It must be. Let me blame AI for my bad research.
I think we should all just blame AI.
That sounds like a plan. Maybe we get shirts made. Let's blame AI.
Exactly. Well, I mean, at some point we're going to run out of runway to blame. But for now, in this teenage phase of AI, I think we can lay blame where it deserves.
Okay. Well, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So, so you're doing IMAX and big screen stuff, and boy, golly, I have to tell you, that's impressive to me. I have a couple of friends of mine who are, in fact, filmmakers, but everything they do is small stuff by comparison. IMAX, you've got a scope issue. I mean, everything has to be big there.
It does, but, you know, storytelling,
yes.
Roger. I mean, whether it's just, is it compelling? Is it authentic? Are there, you know, character arcs and everything? Sometimes people who work in the fiction world as opposed to nonfiction, they have all these judgments about, well, you know, people in the documentary world don't understand story in the same way. And we do. It's all the same thing. We're all telling stories. It doesn't really matter the size of the canvas. So I would say that there are some technical challenges, yes. And there's a difference in how the audience maybe relates to the screen. But fundamentally, we're trying to tell a great story that really sort of transforms the audience, or at least changes their understanding of their place in the universe.
You know, I was watching Superpower Dogs, and I was also watching The Last of the Elephant Men, and also you have there was a trailer that you were kind enough to send me that was on Einstein, but the other two for sure specifically. As you can imagine, I have limited time to sit and watch these things.
Sure.
I watch them when I can. And I was just really, really, really sucked in. The Last of the Elephant Man, I thought, well, I could watch this for a few minutes, and I had to force myself to turn it off. That's good storytelling. It's very compelling storytelling, and it doesn't matter how big the screen is. And then in your trailer about the film that you've done about Einstein, even the trailer was interesting. I mean, yeah. So I think that's a real art, just being able to tell that story.
Well, I appreciate it, Roger, and that's my goal, really. Is, I mean, again, the greatest sin of the filmmaker is to be boring, right? And so what we're trying to do is just, even if it's not your cup of tea, you think, well, I'm sort of not really interested in this subject matter. It's like a book. You pick it up and all of a sudden, you know, you're 50, 60 pages in and you just can't put the thing down. And I think
right.
It needs to be the same way where all of these screens are vying for your attention. I have the fortune in that a lot of the films that I make for theatrical, the audience is captive, you know, so they've chosen to hopefully turn off their phones and turn off the world a little bit and give me their attention. And that's an immense privilege to have. So I don't take it lightly.
Yeah, I tend to agree. There is a great deal of competition for our time. Time has become very valuable and terribly easy to waste, and we don't want to do that. Well, some of us don't, some do. Yeah, I think that was the thing that I noticed. Now, for the most part, your stuff is either going into IMAX theaters or you're going into other institutions. I mean, the New England film, for example, is. Science Museum of Boston, as I recall.
That's right.
Right. So, did they commission that?
The Museum of Science, Boston did, yes. I mean, they sort of relentlessly pursued us, you know, because we're sort of, I'd like to think of us as we're slightly iconoclasts of the IMAX world, and that I just am not interested in making the same movie that's been made so many times. I look for novel subjects, or what you might call niche subjects, and I look for interesting, or at least novel ways of telling something that you might have seen. So, you know, when I made Jerusalem, or even the Dogs film, I mean, gosh, there's so much done on Jerusalem. It's so well trodden, and dogs are everywhere online. It's like, what do I have to say that's novel about the subject
Right.
matter? And I think through a lot of research and really applying ourselves, and you know, when I take on a subject matter, I try and see everything I can about it and then find a way to swim up the middle and surprise an audience. Surprise is something I absolutely love. So, you know, you go in and you hopefully get what you paid for. You get what you wanted, but you got something else that you didn't expect at all. And so in the case of the Heart of New England, the Museum of Science Boston had a signature film that played since 1987. It was narrated by Leonard Nimoy. It's perfectly charming, but a little dated, called New England Time Capsule. And they said, well, we want to replace this, and we've got a healthy budget, and we really want you to make it. And there was a whole process, an RFP. And I presented a fairly ambitious vision that involved live theater and film and everything. And we sort of settled on where we did, but I'm really happy with how the film turned out. It plays several times a day in Boston, and it's designed for their dome for the museum. You know, it's not something generic. It actually addresses you, the audience, sitting in that theater at this moment in time and space.
Wow.
And I think it's fun. It's kind of like going to the Sphere or going to a venue specific film. And a lot of those don't get made anymore, where the Museum of Science Boston really took a chance, and I wish more museum and institutions would say, no, we want something that only an audience has to come to our venue to see something made for us. And frankly, that's why, you know, Mindy Kaling and Uzo Aduba and a lot of the sort of New England celebrities that agreed to be part of the film did it, because they love the Museum of Science Boston. They grew up going to see that old movie, and the idea of replacing it with something was a kind of a thrill for them. And I didn't want to make a tourist movie. And that's not my, it's not what I do, really. It's just, I think about how do I weave a series of narratives that's kind of a meditation on the land we now call New England, but from multiple perspectives. That's something that's really interesting to me. So what does it mean for the many, many indigenous peoples, the indigenous nations of what we now call New England, to have this 15,000 year plus history in the land, as far as the archaeological record is concerned? What is this place, this land, the northeast tip of Turtle Island? What does it mean to them? And then what does it mean for a new New Englander? So someone who's just moved there, who's discovering the place and all of its mythology. And I love sort of taking that and smashing it together, so it's no one thing. So again, that element of surprise and sort of shaking of expectations is interesting to me.
I think a lot of people that aren't from there and haven't visited there think of New England as not existing prior to the American Revolution. So I think they're surprised at perhaps there is a history that goes back thousands of years. And a film like yours obviously would make that abundantly clear.
Yeah, that's what I adore, kind of sneaking in and watching films that I've done or other colleagues with audiences, because I think that's how it should be, you know, a full house of people in the dark, emoting and in some cases tearing up. Emotion's really important in my films, but I think you have to really earn it. And you do that by casting, you know, finding the right characters, real stories, hopefully, to follow, not something that you've sort of recreated. A lot of that happens, but audiences are incredibly sophisticated. You know, we have an amazing story in the New England film of three generations of Penobscot, or as they would say, Panawabskik, spirit runners, who come from a long, long line of running and delivering messages in that culture, who live in what is now Maine. And so we've got grandfather, mother, and granddaughter, and all of them run the Boston Marathon together as a way of sort of saying both we are still here, but also as a way of helping to save their land and their river, the Panawabskik, the Penobscot River. And it was a way of, for me to tie these narratives together as they removed several, they and other organizations, conservation organizations, removed these major dams along the Penobscot River. And this is happening throughout New England. So it's a microcosm of what's going on in the larger New England story. As they do this, the alewife, the fish that feeds all, returns. And you have this immense running of the fish every spring, which is a part
Wow.
of the seasonality of New England as well. And we tie that back to the Gulf of Maine and the phytoplankton and that whole web of life. So it's a way of actually pulling all the stories in, the Boston Marathon, the running of the alewife, the restoration of an ecosystem, and the story of an indigenous people who have a long-standing connection to this place through something that you wouldn't normally expect. And so we weave this together throughout the film. And I think it's you know profoundly moving. It was for me to shoot it.
Now, how long does it take for a production like that, for example? And I know each one is different, but how long, what's the process from the time you say okay and yank the paperwork to the time you finally see it and are able to premiere it?
Well, it's you're right, Roger. They're all different, but you know, sometimes they take about 4 years on average. And when I say 4 years, it's really like there's generally a year or two to raise the money, which is always the hardest part. Especially now, you know, a lot of the sources of funding, the National Science Foundation, a lot of the non-for-profits have left the IMAX business or are leaving, which is really sad. And so, you know, money's always been hard to come by because these films are not cheap, the large screen stuff. But let's say you were able to raise the money and it takes you a year or two. Hopefully, it's probably about a year to shoot the movie and then a year to post the movie. So all of the editing and the visual effects and the music and all of that. And obviously, the nature of the giant screen world is that it's very unforgiving technically. So you want, you know, the highest possible resolution, the best quality sound, and all these things. So there's kind of a minimum, I say, price of entry to making these films look truly superlative, and hopefully knocking the audience socks off. But so, you know, 4 years is about the average. When I made Jerusalem, that was a very different process because, you know, it took me about 11 trips to Jerusalem before I even rolled camera,
Wow.
just building trust with all of the various constituencies. That was a very difficult film, as you could possibly imagine, because of the level of diplomacy and trust building that was involved. In Last of the Elephant Men, I spent a fair bit of time on the Vietnamese-Cambodian border. You know, I lived in Phnom Penh for several months, and then I was going back and forth and trying to figure out a lot of the characters I wanted to profile passed away before we started shooting, and I felt like I was at the end of an era of these old hunters who would go into the forest and demand permission from the spirits to take an elephant and domesticate it, which is a, you know, from a Western perspective, it's a very questionable practice, but we found an old man in Vietnam who'd caught something like 280 elephants in his lifetime. And he had this regret that maybe he took too many from the forest. And he was asking the spirits, the forest spirits, sort of to forgive him. And that was kind of, you know, there had a mythology about it. It was very powerful psychologically. And unfortunately, that individual passed away and it became very difficult to work on the Vietnamese side of the border for a number of issues. But I then eventually, after about a year, found an equivalent character in Cambodia where it's a lot easier to work. So that's an example, Roger, of You sometimes just follow the story. It tells you what it needs. And sometimes it just needs the fullness of time, that there's a right time to make that movie. And so we like to control it. I wish it were shorter, but sometimes, it knocks the stuffing out of us. And before we know it, we have much more gray hair.
Or in my case, none at all. So now a show like that, now was that on commission also, or did that idea, was it, did that germinate at Cosmic Picture, where you're at?
The Last of the Elephant Men was my original idea. It's a bit of a long story, but I've loved elephants for a long time, and I traveled extensively in Southeast Asia, Africa as well. But I'm fascinated by the relationships of animal and people. And I saw the idea for a story. I read an article about this particular elephant hunter. I went to find him. He gave me hours and hours and hours of interviews. As I mentioned, it's harder to work with some of the indigenous communities, the minority communities in the Central Highlands of Vietnam. There's a long history there. So I found it easier to work on the Cambodian side, but that was my own idea, and I tried to shop it around. And that's actually not something I did with Cosmic. I did that with a group here in Quebec called Information, and then a group in France called Taxi Brousse. And it was broadcast on French television and here in Quebec as well. And it got a theatrical run here and in France. Partially in Germany as well. So, every and that was a much, that's probably compared to some of the multi-million dollar IMAX films. That was probably about half a million dollars, to make that film. But it still took a great deal of effort of really embedding with the Benong tribe, and finding our characters on the fly. But so th that was a project of passion of just I had a lot to say about the relationship of indigenous communities to wildlife, and the sort of what I saw as a vanishing world. I mean, there's a lot of projects about that, but there was something really quite spiritual in the bond between indigenous people and the elephant in particular, based on their mythology. The Benong people believe that elephants are humans in alternate form. Their mythology suggests that in the case the film that two brothers went fishing and one of them caught a magical fish, ate it, and transformed to an elephant. Didn't want to be alone and begged half of the village to eat the same fish, which they did. So their destinies are entwined, and so that's a it's a powerful myth when you understand that these are people who traditionally, along in Cambodia and Laos and parts of Vietnam, were sort of the experts at in places in Thailand as well, but of domesticating elephants, which is a really tricky thing now. I mean, they're just from the Western perspective, as you probably gather, you go out there and you ride an elephant if you're not aware of some of the issues. And thankfully, I think that practice is going away, and now we're favoring, a different kind of relationship with elephants. But you have a group of people who had this profound bond, and who used elephants from everything from being a tractor to being the priest in a village or the conscience of a village. It's a very sort of strange, ethereal relationship, but something that I just drew my attention. And so I found a series of characters of multi-generations who had really strong bonds with elephants, and I just followed them, just verite, fly on the wall. And that film was immensely successful. It won a ton of awards, a lot of Canadian Emmys, was seen by a lot of people, it sort of was very hard to make. All these films are hard to make, Roger. I mean, that's the thing, is they take pints of blood and they're labors of love, and hopefully the audience will respond to them in the way that you saw the spark in the beginning.
Oh, yeah. So, I'm kind of stunned here for a second, but the other t another talk, blah, blah, blah. Let me see if I can say that in English. The other another film that I watched part of was Supernatural or Superpowered Dog, and one of the things that really struck me, and I want to go back and watch more of that because I wasn't able to finish it, but what really the opening of that thing. We're talking about a movie about dogs, and all of a sudden, we're above the mountains in this huge big, enormous vista, and now we're following some skier going down, which starts our story. And I'm looking at this, I'm going, holy mackerel. I mean, it would have been much easier to do it in a much smaller, a different sort of way. So, A, I applaud you for that, but I find that to be very compelling storytelling as well. I mean, it just kind of sucks you in. I mean, it's almost like the cold opening to a James Bond movie. I mean, it's pretty
That's
amazing.
exactly how it was designed, Richard. Is Roger? I'm very careful about the projects that I pick, and because I know I'm gonna have to spend years on them, and it's like, do you want to work on a movie about serial killers or whatever for years and years? I mean, whatever you do, you bring your work home with you, whether you like it or not.
Of
And I
course.
love the idea that with these projects, I get to learn. My whole life, I'm just doing these master theses, if you like that's kind of how it is for me. So like school never ended, and I love that. I go deep. I read everything I can. I'm not a dog guy. I didn't grow up with dogs. I've always been interested, but I never thought I'd make a film about them. And then one of my business partners came up and said, I'd love to do something on dogs. And I just didn't see it. IMAX is about, well, maybe elephants or blue whales or something, and go to the top of Mount Everest, and that's fine. But it's not an immediate, oh yeah, of course, dogs needs the IMAX treatment. It needs to be six, eight stories tall. So I was kind of skeptical, but then I saw this hook of, wait a minute, what if our whole obsession with superheroes, because our culture is so, I mean, we always have been, whether it's Hercules or these epics that we followed, or whether it's Captain America. We are fascinated, but what if I kind of tease this out? What if superheroes are actually real, and what if they're our best friends? What if they're dogs? Because it just allowed me to play a little bit in this idea that, well, dogs can run faster, they have better vision, their sense of smell is incredibly developed. They see they sort of smell the past and the future. I mean, there's really profound things that a dog. And then I came up with this idea that the right dog paired with the right human, I mean, it's like one plus one equals 10. That's the idea of a dog who can save someone in an avalanche or from drowning, or who can track down wildlife poachers over hundreds of miles, or a dog who can save your soul. I mean, in the case of people who are suffering from trauma or post-traumatic stress or whatever it is. And I think any dog person would be like, yeah, I knew all that, but to be able to kind of break down the science of that and have your pet teach you something profound about the universe. That I think is what IMAX does best. So I had this idea that I would treat it like a superhero movie. And I would kind of poke fun a little bit about, our whole obsession with Marvel and DC and everything. And I would shoot it like a graphic novel, that it would be big, bright colors, as you say, open like a James Bond movie. And I would use the language from those kinds of films to inform a movie about ultimately our bond with canines. And of course, then we got Chris Evans to narrate it, Captain America himself, who dog lover. And so that just, it helped to raise it to the point where hopefully it feels both epic and also intimate, in the sense that we followed a puppy for 3 years, our sort of Peter Parker, our sort of Luke Skywalker, as it discovers its potential. And that was kind of thrilling, because I think that no matter what you do, no matter what story you set out to tell, at least in this sort of documentary hybrid world of IMAX and giant screen, having something that's real that the audience can grab onto and say, this is authentically real. Like, they just put the cameras in the right place at the right time and got magic. And that's, I think, sometimes what IMAX does best. Is yes, spectacle, absolutely, but sometimes just to capture that level of intimacy where someone allows you into their own life at the right moment, can be equally profound. And I think balancing those two things out, of the intimate and the spectacular, is it's a winning combination.
Now, how much of this is storyboarded and how much of this is on the fly?
I like to storyboard everything, but within that, I improvise. So, I think that I script all my movies like they're fiction. So the beats are thought out. That allows me to know where I think the money should go, as far as some of the big setups.
Sure.
But you know how it is, Roger. You get lucky on the day. You know the weather cooperates or doesn't, or someone's having a good day, or the dog's not performing, or whatever it is. There's a million things that can happen.
Right.
And then, but I like to be extremely prepared. And you know the thing about it is that when you've got storyboards, when you've got a template, when you have a plan, apart from just a shot list and a sort of, I think we're going to do this today, and you share that with everyone well in advance, then it encourages everyone to give you their best ideas as well about how to achieve what you're looking for. And if there's one thing I've learned is that, I mean, for me, the best film directors are people who create an atmosphere, a very collaborative atmosphere, where they're soliciting all the best ideas, because you know you don't want to ever feel like you're the smartest person in the room. You want to be surrounded by, and you want to create that climate where people are suggesting fixes, because it's nothing but problem solving at every level. Sometimes it's political and sometimes just purely technical and whatever. But if you surround yourself with sort of hopefully like-minded people, that the film will just get better and better and better if you empower those people. And that's what I love about cinema, is that it is this sort of collective art where, if done right, if everyone's motivated and if everyone's moving to the same sort of North Star, then you know, it's kind of magical. I don't even know how. Any good film is a miracle to pull off. It really is. But it takes sort of constantly pushing that boulder up the hill, but also making sure that you're not never pushing it up alone.
And to your point, I always tell people that it's my job sitting here talking to folks that I'm always the dumbest person in the room, so you don't have to be.
Well, then you're doing something right. I mean, if that's how you feel, and I don't believe you for a second, but you know, sometimes you have to pinch yourself and say, like, how did I get to this point where I had an idea? You know, the thing is, a film producer or director, we're sort of conjurers. Like, we conjure things out of midair, and we might read an article, we hear an interview, we get a kernel of an idea for a story, we try it, we ask people, we pitch it, and then suddenly it just starts to roll. It has this momentum. I mean, part of it is what's meant to be, and that's going to be determined by, can you raise the money for it or not, or whatever. Can you sustain your passion long enough that you can convince everyone else, hopefully, that this is something worth embarking on? And if you can do that, then hopefully you can sustain that all the way through, you know, a brutal slog of financing and shooting and posting and then distributing, because that's where you can also, you know, sadly fumble the ball, is like the whole marketing and presenting to an audience and making it, you know, I mean, a lot of people, just great movies come and go, but like, how do you tap into the zeitgeist is the other thing. There's a lot out there, and why some great movies don't land and other mediocre movies do. And but that's the thing, it all comes back to me, for I've always loved stories in general, but particularly my parents didn't let me watch television until I was five, but they showed me Star Wars when I was four, and that really blew my mind. You know, I remember everything about it. I remember early experiences. I remember going to see Raiders of the Lost Ark, my mother covering my eyes during the melting faces scene, and so those were pretty visceral moments for a kid who didn't have television. Was to associate movies to displacement. Like, you have to leave your house, you have to put away, you know, your sort of creature comforts. We're all used to streaming now and so forth, but I still try and go and see a movie every week if I can, to the theater. There's nothing I love more than sitting in a room with strangers, and it's a totally different experience. I would, you know, guess that the neurons in the brain that are firing during a giant screen or a theatrical experience are perhaps different from ones that, not in terms of, you can still have an amazing emotional experience watching it on the small screen with a glass of wine, but there's something about the act of leaving your home, and hopefully it's a good movie, but you know, you're sitting down with this group of strangers and being immersed in big picture and big sound, in a way that feels like you've kind of left your world for a moment. You really have. You've traveled. You've gone somewhere, and you've returned. And then, so for me, the most formative experiences, you know, 2001: A Space Odyssey, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, those big, big screen movies, They really felt like I had gone off world, or I had
Right.
gone to the desert and back. And I remember when I was young, I went to see Lawrence of Arabia in 70 millimeter, and that was really formative for me. I remember the intermission came up and everyone ran for the water fountains. Like, it was just the proof that that film had been immersive for me. And there's so many examples of that that just kind of stayed with me.
The lockdown had a profound effect on the way we or the way audiences in general go to movies. I mean, it's had kind of a detrimental effect, as I understand. The numbers are down and haven't come back up. How has that affected what you do?
It's affected all of us. I think it's going to take us, I don't know, perhaps decades to really digest what the pandemic meant. And I meant something different for everyone, but I think what we retain of it will be, we might have to look back and understand what this meant as a sort of an inflection point, a societal inflection point. I don't think we've quite digested it yet, but as far as the movies go, I think it accelerated a natural, sadly, a natural decline of theatrical experience. And we've had a couple of bumps, obviously, Barbenheimer and that kind of thing, and Sinners, and hopefully a couple of other like event type pictures
Right.
where you have this sense that, boy, if I miss this thing on the big screen, then my life will be impoverished in some way. And I wish that people had more appetite for that. It seems like people tend to go to the movies just a handful of times a year for the biggest ones. And that's understandable. We're all very busy and it's become incredibly convenient. But yeah, we're probably, across the board in the giant screen world, in the IMAX world. I mean, IMAX in terms of the Hollywood blowup films is doing fairly well because it's got an incredible premium release form for things like the Christopher Nolan film and the Ryan Coogler's Sinners film, and even, Mission Impossible and those kind of things. So that side of things, I think, is doing well, and it's a bit insulated because people look at it, well, boy, if I'm going to spend the money and go to the movies, I want the best possible experience. I'm going to go for IMAX, whatever the premium equivalent is. But the museum type films, or the sort of documentary films, that has still suffered in terms of people are so either field trip budgets are cut or families are cutting back. And I think there's a sense of, well, boy, it's expensive to pay for a whole family and popcorn and this and that. And there may be a sense of, are we really getting value for our money? And at the same time, Roger, we have all these immersive experiences that are popping up everywhere. These sort of the Van Goghs and the Monets, and I don't know, whatever it is. You go to a room and you look at all these paintings on a bunch of screens, and some of
Sure.
them are better than others, but people are willing to shell out like $30, $40 of VR experiences of the new technology. And yet, we still have something incredibly special in this giant screen immersive IMAX world, or even the planetarium world. And I think we're in the cusp of something interesting. LED is coming, LED screens. The sphere is big news. The COSM technology is big news. These sort of immersive domes. And I think that these dome theaters and these planetariums, they might have the last laugh in terms of people feeling like, we need to go to this. We need to leave the house and spend the money, and it's worth it. And we're going to talk about it. And I miss those collective experiences where everyone was talking about the same thing, and there was a
Right.
sense of a common culture. And I think movies were a big part of that. And I hope that they will continue to be that. It's just that how the public they become a bit disposable. I think that's unfortunate, is that movies have become these sort of little icons on your screen that you can click through, and they just they've lost a little bit of their sheen, I can't deny that the romanticism I had with lining up to see the new Kieślowski film, or the Neil Spielberg film, or whatever it is, I wish that that were there. But I have a great hope, and actually maybe the generation, what do you call it, alpha, like, maybe, I don't know. I hate painting generations with brushes, but I feel like, in certainly in my kids, they are maybe rediscovering the joys of analog. We started this conversation talking
Sure.
about like the joys of maybe, whether it's vinyl or discovering things, or like going to tape or whatever that means, or old musical instruments, or And maybe that's a reaction towards artificial intelligence or things that are far too polished or the ubiquity of CGI or everything is to say, wait a minute, maybe we moved a little too quickly. We can still love our first child, now that we have child number two and three and four, right? Like, and there's a lot of value in that. And so I would hope that maybe the younger generation might discover, hopefully, the joys of the theatrical experience if we can keep the level of projection quality up and if we can continue to make really beautiful and important movies.
So with the new technique, you were talking about domes, and I know your Einstein movie, it's also available in 3D, I believe. Am I remembering that right? And
Yes.
so that takes some pretty specialized equipment to do all of that, doesn't it? And also, and I guess the second part of that question is, how does that change in the editing room when you're in post? That's that whole putting it together thing is different than sticking a couple pieces of celluloid together.
Yeah, the technology is a bit cumbersome. There's a larger footprint sometimes, but listen, we used to I when I started working in the in large format or sort of the 70 millimeter format, IMAX is a 15 perforations along the top horizontal and it's a 70 millimeter. It's big like this,
Okay.
I think actually here you go. I always have one. This is I don't know if you can see that, but
I
that's
can,
like
yeah, wow, that's huge.
yeah. So that's there's two frames. That's two frames, in
Oh,
terms of the size of
jeez.
that. I'm imagining 24 of these going through the camera at once, and that's why the camera sounded like a machine gun. I mean, they're noisy things. So we used to have to shoot. We were shooting on film, and I still think, and I know that many agree with me, that film is still the gold standard. I also believe in tools for the trade. So whatever story you're telling, like, don't be a slave to the technology. We all wish we could be Christopher Nolan and shoot reams and reams of 70 millimeter, 15 per film or 5 per for whatever it is. But that's an unwieldy, well, that's just to give you an idea, like 3 minutes, so 1,000 feet of film, just to buy it is $1,500 or $1,800. And then to process and print and develop it and get 35 millimeter print downs to work with it, you're like $5,000 for 3 minutes. I mean, it really adds up. So thankfully, the digital world has come along and the cameras have improved enough that we have now large enough sensors that can hopefully try and match the beauty and the color space and the texture of a 70 millimeter film. That's arguable. People have different points of view about it. The point is that we try and give the audience the best possible immersive experience. And in some cases, that is 3D, despite I have certain feelings about, I don't detest 3D. I think that it can be done beautifully. Like if 3D is done well, and if it adds to the story, it's a thing of beauty. I mean, Martin Scorsese's Hugo is an example, and there's some beautiful 3D films. There's the 3D is part of the design. It's not like the joke about the D standing for dollars, like three extra dollars, the dollar grab, or whatever. I mean, and unfortunately, and or like the I will say the James Cameron films, like those using high frame rate or 3D. I mean, I think that that's a kind of a perfect marriage of really using the technology to take you on an incredible, indelible journey that becomes part of the attraction if done well. Unfortunately, it's often done poorly, but so that means you have to shoot with two cameras, either with a parallel system of for the left eye and the right eye, or what I prefer is a mirror egg system where you sort of have a mirror between two cameras and one camera's going up and the other camera's looking forward and you're able to adjust the distance between those
Oh,
using the
wow.
rig to simulate the what we call the interocular distance, the distance between your eyes, and that allows us to change convergence. So how much things are going to come out of the screen or how much things are going to recede into the screen, and those are all very subjective decisions. But that's an important part of the storytelling. You want to build a 3D arc for the movie. You don't want to just be poking people's eyes out the whole time. You want to kind of like anything, like music, you want to build dynamic range so that the audience is going on a journey with you. And so sometimes they forget about the 3D maybe, but then they're reminded and it comes in and out but you need to be very conscientious about how that helps the story. And the same goes for when you're filming for a dome screen where every shot is a subjective shot because the screen surrounds your periphery and it tricks your brain into believing you're there. So there's always this sort of virtual reality, you know, the camera moves over a cliff edge and you feel that sort of vertigo. And if you do that too much, you can maybe annoy the audience or make a lot of people physically sick. But if done properly, I think it can really enhance the story. It's just understanding how to use the technology in the case of domes with the best fisheye lenses. And, you know, in other cases, you want to, it's all about what is the best technology to tell the best story for the best venue. I don't know if that's possible everywhere, and that's why A Heart of New England is nice because it's a dome-only film. It's a single-venue piece, whereas Einstein has to work for every possible venue, you know, sort of widescreen and square 4:3 traditional IMAX. It has to work for more of a sort of dome spherical planetarium. That's a whole other thing. So your relationship to the screen, you know, you're not, I always say to my cinematographers, you know, you're not in a theater watching a screen of someone on a boat. You're on the boat. You're
Right.
on the boat. And that's what I mean by when I say every shot is sort of subjective and how to use that to your advantage at the right moments, because I can turn you into a shark scientist who's tagging great whites off the coast of Cape Cod. I can also turn you into an octopus. You know, like, I mean, if I can sort of you know, I mean, in some cases, I just shift the point of view. So, you know, I show you that person, but then I take you into their world, or in a sense, they might not be human, as I was indicating. Is that that's I think what large format immersive cinema does best is it takes you into the world of the other. So I did a film before Jerusalem that I was involved in. It was called Journey to Mecca, which is a cosmic film, and it was the conceit was, could we take the audience on the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, from the point of view of a pilgrim in the 14th century and today? So you know, and for me, this is a fascinating exercise because you know, IMAX began taking people to places they could never otherwise go.
Sure.
Space being, you know, one of them, or the deep oceans, or some of the top of Mount Everest. I mean, these are the what we remember. And the Mecca film, because I'm not Muslim and I didn't convert to make the movie, but I worked with 85 brilliant Muslim artists from around the world who went in and made Umrah and Hajj and filmed with these IMAX film cameras and brought back the most exquisite footage.
Wow.
Really quite intimate, but gave me a new appreciation and made me feel when I saw the images on an IMAX screen like I was there.
Wow.
And so it that idea of taking you into the world of another, Roger Ebert said that cinema is an empathy box. And I really think that's a great way of describing it, is that for an hour and a half or even 45 minutes, you can enter into the life of someone you never thought you would do. Look at a film like Honeyland, a beautiful documentary of a woman who's gathering honey from wild bees in Macedonia. I mean, I've never been there. I don't know what it means to raise bees in Macedonia or whatever. I'm using that as an example. There's so many
Course.
films where I feel like I was a concert pianist in Poland, you know, or whatever. But I didn't have that life, so it allows us to live these other lives, not just of other you know, sentient bipedal beings, but you know, maybe other species or eventually other forms of intelligent life. And so I think it's a powerful medium that we're still at the very beginning of understanding what the seventh art has to teach us.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much. Believe it or not, we're out of time. And I have so enjoyed this conversation. Honestly, I've got about 35 million more questions and I could sit here till supper time. But I have really, really, really enjoyed this. And I hope you'll consider doing it again sometime soon and we'll continue this conversation. And I'll try to turn off my AI before I begin.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Roger. It's a great conversation.
Thank you. Talk to you soon, I hope. I'd like to thank Dan for taking the time to talk about his movies, his process, and his other projects. If you'd like to know more about Dan, his production company, and projects, there is a link in the description below. Also, Don't forget to go to www.rogerhumphrey.com and subscribe to my blog. It's a great way to get updates on all of my guests. I promise, no spam, ever. And thank you also for spending time with us. Don't forget to grab some friends and share some of your favorite episodes of Creative Conversations with Roger Humphrey.